Last year we talked about the coming of the new year and all of the anxiety that people have about the future. Anxiety about war dogs us. What's going to happen with Iran and trying to shut down the Red Sea? What's going on with Russia and the Ukraine? Now we'll have the second anniversary of that war coming up in February. Will China finally try to make good on its desire to pull Taiwan back into its orbit? And will the United States be involved in that? Will there be an Asian war and a European war we haven't had? Well, it's been a long time since the Second World War, but those kinds of jitters are among us. Violence and the threat of violence are tremendous political tools. We worry about, well, after January 6th, will America stay stable? What will happen during the elections? Fears motivate, and I expect both parties to come out basically their campaign strategy being, be afraid of the other party, trust us. Tends to be how it goes. But among us, there are some things that I call status quo kingdoms. That's the form and the shape of life as it is now. It's sort of the soft power, it's the habits, it's the bonds we don't see, it's the things we have gotten accustomed to that don't change. It's the kind of decisions we make when we excuse and justify them by saying, I didn't have any choice, so I had to do this, even if it wasn't a good thing. This limits us and quietly captures us. I was reading a story about an imam in Gaza. I assume it's a son, who wrote the story of his father in Gaza, who basically was not towing the line to Hamas and what Hamas wanted him to say. And so he was kidnapped and disappeared, and now his son is worried because will he resurface? Because regimes and governments and groups have a way of just sort of silencing what they don't want to hear and promoting a particular party line. That's sort of a status quo kingdom. Now, this is a common subtext throughout history of people comparing their expectations of good, bad, right, and wrong to the status quo, making the assertion that change is needed. And so again, in this election year, incumbents will say, things are good, don't change. Those who would like to supplant them in office will say, change is needed, things are bad, and on it goes. And then some, in fact, will use the demand for change to justify violence. Take almost any headline today and you can fit it into this narrative. Hamas's attack was justified because of oppression. Jews deserve a homeland because of oppression. You can justify almost anything because of a sense of oppression. And we easily assume that the revolution is the fastest way to overturn a situation and usher in a better reality. Probably very few of you have heard about the Bar Kokhba rebellion at the beginning of the 2nd century AD. The Bar Kokhba rebellion was a Jewish uprising against the Roman Empire. It was the third one. The first one resulted in the destruction of the temple in 70 AD. And then there was another one. Bar Kokhba was the third one. He claimed to be a Messiah or the Messiah for the Jewish people, and people rallied around him. Rome, after the first two rebellions, had basically outlawed circumcision. The temple had been destroyed, and the Romans were trying to keep the Jews out of Jerusalem and trying to Hellenize the area. And so one of the thoughts that Emperor Hadrian had was, well, what if we build a temple to Jupiter on top of that Temple Mount? Maybe then the Jews will sort of join in with the rest of us. And as you can imagine, it had almost exactly the opposite thing. So Bar Kokhba organized a revolt, and for a while it had a fair amount of success. But eventually the Romans got their legions together, and Julius Severus came down with his legions and destroyed the rebellion. There were heavy casualties, destruction, and basically the Romans said to the Jews, you may no longer be in this region. And the kind of spreading that out that had happened, the Babylonian exile, happened all over again. Wasn't this the kind of Messiah that everyone was looking for? Last week we began again in the Gospel of Mark, and the Gospel of Mark begins with this very dramatic beginning. The beginning of the good news, the genesis of the good news about Jesus, the Messiah, the Son of God. And right away you have to ask the question, what do you mean by Messiah? Bar Kokhba was a Messiah. David was a Messiah. The Maccabees were Messiahs. Was Jesus a Messiah? What did he tear down? What did he build up? It's amazing that if we're at the beginning of the second century, and if you were living in Judea, all of you would have known the name Simon Bar Kokhba and Simon Maccabees. You go a little further out, hardly anyone would say, Jesus of Nazareth? Oh yeah, he was that guy. They crucified him. His disciples said he's risen, and they still sort of meet together. But it wouldn't have seemed a very big deal. Yet today, I say Simon Bar Kokhba, and you say, who? I say Jesus, and you say, well, everybody knows about Jesus. So Jesus, Simon and Andrew, James and John, the son of Zebedee, left their fishing, and they went to Capernaum. And when Sunday came, when the Sabbath came, not Sunday, Saturday, the Sabbath came, Jesus went into the synagogue and began to teach. The people were amazed at his teaching because he taught them as one who had authority, not as the teachers of the law. Now remember last week I told you that the Gospel of Mark quite likely comes from Mark, the disciple of Peter, who listened to Peter preaching. He listened to these stories over and over again, and Peter was there, and he remembers Jesus going into these synagogues, and the way a synagogue worked was they would have readings from the Torah, and then some would be invited to stand up and give a comment on the Torah or the prophets and invite application of that. And the teachers of the law were those who, like myself in some ways, were professional in trying to take the Torah and help it apply to people's lives. Jesus stands up, and they're shocked at what they hear from him. Authority has a sense that what Jesus was saying seemed to fit. It had power. It gained traction in the world they were living within. It was an intuitive sense that, in contrast to what they'd heard from others, his words had meaning. Power seemed to have agency and efficacy to accomplish what they sort of thought was good and right. So they're in the synagogue, and Jesus is teaching, and then something happens. Just then, a man in their synagogue who was possessed by an impure spirit cried out, "What do you want with us, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God." Now this, I'm sure, took everyone by surprise. Now notice, Mark calls it an impure spirit, and that sort of connects us with the Old Testament. And if you go back and read the Old Testament, you hear about clean and unclean. You hear about holy and common. You have all of these rules about when something gets defiled. Defiled but because of blood. Defiled because of contact with certain animals. You have clean animals and unclean animals. You have this entire system. And now when we hear this, we hear an impure spirit. spirit, unclean spirit, but most of us think demon possession. That is a category in our mind, especially if you grew up in church and you think about maybe foaming at the mouth or erratic behavior, something that has basically undermining this human being. And what's amazing is that this person probably came to synagogue every week, and now this week with Jesus preaching, whoosh, this thing comes out. And nobody knows what to think about it. And then he says, I know who you are. You've come to destroy us. Well, who's us? Now, demon possession has its own sense. And people today, if you would go out on the street, someone would say, well, that's just mental illness, or that's just made up. So some are skeptical about conscious non-human agents who can occupy and overcome human beings. Others are not skeptical about this at all. But we often in church sort of have a fuzzy idea that connects with something sort of spooky and miraculous. Now, Jesus immediately says, be quiet, come out of him. And the impure spirit shook the man violently and came out of him with a shriek. Now, everybody would have remembered this Sabbath in the synagogue. Now, let's assume for a minute the evil non-human agent hypothesis. Why would a demon out Jesus like this? Most of us think that Jesus is going to be sort of, well, unknown. And so what would help Jesus most of all to be a Messiah would be to be declared to be a Messiah by lots of people. But Jesus silences him. Now, naming is framing, and once he says, you're the Holy One of God, how would everyone hear that? In a Jewish community, to claim to be a military political rescuer, well, that's okay. To claim to be someone sent from God? The Greeks, the Romans, the Egyptians, the Persians, they would all imagine that the gods are about descending in human form. Alexander was the son of God. Caesar was the son of God. Everyone was the son of a god. But in a Jewish community, you don't talk like that or you get stoned. The demon wanted to resist Jesus and thought that maybe naming Jesus might give him a desperate edge in the conflict, and it didn't work at all. But why didn't Jesus want the fame? I'm sure when Simon Bar Kokhba was trying to build his movement, he wanted everybody to know his name, and everybody to hear him, everybody to think a lot of him, so that when people would come to him, he could direct them. He would sort of move them as one. Wasn't that sort of what the demon is doing? The demon possesses a man, takes control of a man, and moves him as one. And Simon Bar Kokhba wants to come into the nation, have everybody hear about him, and move the nation as one against the Romans. Jesus doesn't seem to want this. What would fame help Jesus in his mission? What exactly is Jesus' mission? How would both the demon's naming his framing strategy against Jesus and the word of mouth promotion undermine Jesus' mission? The people were so amazed that they asked each other, what is this? A new teaching and with authority. He even gives orders to impure spirits and they obey him. News about him spread quickly over the whole region. You can't keep that quiet. And I tell you, if something would have happened even in a quiet little church like this, next week there'd be throngs of onlookers saying, is it going to happen again? Can I see it happen? I want to hear him shriek. I want to see him writhe on the floor. And you know, the minute that happened, phones would be out everywhere, right? And everybody would be recording it. What is this sense of authority? People sort of know that talk is cheap. But when Jesus tells this spirit to come out, out it comes. Jesus' talk seems to do something. It moves people. It expels demons. Now, popularity is coming, but this way of using popularity seems to make Jesus uncomfortable. Yet, he doesn't seem to be able to stop it. As soon as they left the synagogue, they went with James and John to the home of Simon and Andrew. Simon's mother-in-law was in bed with a fever, and they immediately told Jesus about her. So he went to her, took her hand, and helped her up. The fever left her, and she began to wait on them. Now Jesus is still with the four disciples, and Simon's mother-in-law has a fever. Now remember this clean and unclean stuff, this pure and impure stuff. Sometimes it's connected with sick and well. Certain illnesses make you unclean, and then when you're beyond that illness, you have to do a sacrifice to be declared clean again. And with certain illnesses, not even illnesses, for example, women in their menstrual cycle would have to leave the camp because the issue of blood would make them unclean. Men, if they had an emission of semen, an involuntary emission of semen in the night, they too would have to leave the camp because they would become unclean. And then there would be some bathing and some washing, and they would join the camp. But certain illnesses would make people unclean. And now notice, on one hand you're talking about demons over here, and the other hand you're talking about illness over there, and it's like, well, how do these two worlds connect with each other? The clean is often preserved by separation. Separation from the non-Jewish elements of their community. We don't eat with Gentiles because they eat pork. We don't eat with them or associate with them because the uncleanliness gets on the money. That's why tax collectors were unclean. That's why prostitutes were unclean, because they would sleep with Gentiles. Now, Jesus touches her. And we might not think anything of that. But remember, we're in the context of clean and unclean, and they were very careful what they touched. Jesus didn't have to touch her. As we see with other miracles, Jesus, even at a distance, could say the word, and the person would be healed, but Jesus takes the time to touch her. Because in the Old Testament, if something was clean and it came into contact with something that was defiled or unclean, the unclean made the clean unclean. What we begin to see is that Jesus, who is clean, is purifying what he touches. A couple of weeks ago, we talked about altars and sacrifice, and the Lord is a refining fire. One of the ways in which something could be purified was by fire, but often, well, my coat, this cloth contacted blood, so it's unclean. Now, fire's not going to be a good way to purify it. But Jesus is like fire, except he doesn't destroy. Jesus is like water, except he doesn't run out. So he touches her, and she's immediately well. That evening after sunset, all the people brought to Jesus all the sick and demon-possessed. Notice how these two ideas are put right next to each other. And also notice that it's after sunset. Last week we talked about desert as chaos and sea as chaos. And habitable order is the mixture of the right amount of land and the right amount of water, and then it works. Then crops grow, then people live. Not enough water, you have desert. Too much water, you have sea. Also, day and night have the same sort of idea. Daytime, you can see, there's light, you can walk around. Nighttime is the time that we're nervous. We can't see what's coming. It's a realm of chaos. Jesus, at nighttime, you see the town gathering, look at the language, at the door. Can you think of another story in the Bible when an entire town gathers at the door at nighttime? It's not a happy story. Sodom. Angels come in to Lot's house, and the town bangs at the door. Let us have these men so we may violate them. Ah, Now the town is at the door where Jesus is saying, they're not wanting to harm Jesus, they want more of Jesus. And Jesus goes out, not like the angels making the town of Sodom blind. Jesus goes out and he's running out the illness and the demons. Jesus is invading the realm of darkness, the status quo kingdom that they have been living in. And the people don't understand it, can't get enough of it, are drawn to it. The whole town gathered at the door, and Jesus healed many who had various diseases. He also drove out many demons. But he would not let the demons speak because they knew who he was. But why doesn't Jesus want them to know who he is? Well, he knows. He wants them to know, but he wants them to know it right. And he knows that the first way they think about him is going to be all wrong. Very early in the morning, while it was still dark, Jesus got up, left the house, and went off to a solitary place where he prayed. He's back out in the wilderness. Remember, it's where God brings Israel. That's where God feeds Israel, brings water out of the rock, brings food out of the sky. Jesus goes out into the wilderness where there aren't a lot of people, and he communes with his Father in the middle of the place that doesn't support life. Simon and his companions went to look for him. And when they found him, they exclaimed, "Everyone is looking for you, Jesus. It's happening. We're popular. Everybody wants, pretty soon, maybe we'll gather weapons. Maybe we'll kick out the Romans. Maybe we'll be your lieutenants." If you read the gospel and you understand the time, you know this is behind everyone's motivation. Jesus replied, "Let's go somewhere else." What? No. You're supposed to stay in Capernaum until you control Capernaum, like a demon controlling that man in the synagogue. You're supposed to occupy Capernaum, and then we'll take town after town. And Jesus is like, "No, we're going somewhere else." To the nearby villages. Villages? No, you should go to the cities. No, we're going to go to the villages. So I can preach there also. Okay. That is why I have come. And probably when he said that, they said, "Huh? That is why I have come? Jesus, you've been living in the Galilee all your life. What do you mean that's why I have come? What is he talking about?" So they traveled throughout the Galilee and preached in their synagogues, driving out demons. This thing keeps happening again and again and again. Then a man with leprosy. That's one of these illnesses that makes people unclean. If you came down with leprosy, you could no longer live in the town. You could no longer live with your family. You had to go live in isolated places, the kind of places Jesus was going to pray. And then suddenly you begin to realize, wait a minute, there's an exchange happening here. Jesus is bringing wellness, and Jesus is going out into the wilderness. There's a substitution that's taking place. A man with leprosy came to him and begged him on his knees, "If you are willing, you can make me clean." Wow. This is faith. He believes. And Jesus was indignant. And this little phrase has bothered scholars and interpreters forever because, well, it's probably Peter just recording what he saw. And everybody who reads the text wants to know, why was Jesus indignant? Was he frustrated with the man? If I am willing, Jesus... Of course I'm willing. Was Jesus frustrated with the man? Was Jesus frustrated with the fact that The status quo kingdom is killing everyone. And so he's frustrated with that. Remember, he's angry outside of the tomb of Lazarus. Was that why? We don't know. Peter just reads Jesus' face and says, he was indignant. And Peter remembered it. He was indignant. Why? I don't know. But he was. He reached out his hand, and again, here it is, he touched the leper. Now, lepers were supposed to walk around saying, unclean, unclean, so no one would accidentally touch them and defile themselves and force them to go through a purification ritual or maybe even contact with the disease. They were worried, so no one would touch them. And Jesus didn't have to touch him, but Jesus does. It's like the fire of the altar. It's like a purifying fire, but the man isn't destroyed, unlike all of the animals that go in the fire of God. I am willing, he said. Be clean. Jesus drives out an unclean spirit. Jesus drives out the fever from Peter's mother-in-law. Jesus drives out the uncleanness. Jesus is turning over a status quo kingdom that people have just all gotten accustomed to. And their focus is on the politics, the Romans. And it's happening. Jesus, by touching, makes clean. Jesus has authority over the normal transmission of clean, whole, well, right, and wrong. Then Jesus sends him away at once with a strong warning. See that you don't tell this to anyone, but go show yourself to the priest and offer the sacrifices that Moses commanded for your cleansing, because that's what you were supposed to do, as a testimony to them. Well, the priest should know that God, that the fire has left the altar and is purifying Israel. That's what John the Baptist was expecting, but with Jesus, this purification is happening in a totally different way that's actually bringing life to the community. It's bringing strength to the wobbly. It's bringing cleanliness to the impure. It's changing the whole status quo kingdom. Instead, he went out and began to speak freely, spreading the news. We don't know if he even did the sacrifice. He didn't obey Jesus. He just went out and kept talking. Now, on one hand, we shouldn't think too badly of the man, because think about his life. His entire life had been disrupted by this disease, and he had to live away from, he had to live in solitary places, in leper colonies where only those who shared his misery were. And now he can go back and live in the village and conduct business and be with his family and be with his kids and grandkids and all of them. He's so thrilled that he forgets to listen to Jesus and obey. And of course, what happens? As a result, Jesus could no longer enter a town openly. The man gets to live in town, and Jesus has to stay in the wilderness. Yet the people still came from everywhere. People, the people themselves, their practices, however natural and understandable, are hampering Jesus' work to push back this status quo kingdom. Jesus himself is now a dweller in the realm of chaos. He's master there too, remember. But people still come to him from everywhere. He will not deny them. He won't turn them away. They are sheep looking for their shepherd in the wilderness. Remember John the Baptist? Remember Israel in the desert? What do demons that yell, "You're the Holy One of God," have in common with fevers, contagious skin diseases, and other things? What did that demon do? It would take over someone's life. It would interrupt. It would disrupt. It would take what should be in the town and send it out into the wilderness. What wholeness does the status quo kingdom not afford? Why did Jesus come? Why would Jesus retreat from the fame and popularity that we assume would be the foundation of what he would do? It's clear nobody understood what he was doing. What did Jesus say that seemed to have so much authority, even if they couldn't understand? Now we have to square this with the rest of what we know about Jesus. He allows himself to be crucified. He rises from the dead. And then his disciples change the world. These clueless ones that don't understand him. They probably, even after they start going after Pentecost, they don't quite even then understand what Jesus is doing. But he's doing it through them. Not like the demon that comes and says, I'm in charge here. Jesus comes in from below and begins to change us in ways we're not quite sure about. But it's happening. And here we are now, continuing to worship him. Simon Bar Kokhba, most of you heard his name for the first time this morning. What is Jesus' kingdom about? How does he address the many status quo kingdoms that have come and gone since then? And we lose our elder just as we're about to have communion. Jesus, on the night he was betrayed, took bread, and he broke it. And again, they thought, well, we're here at the Seder. We do this every year. There's the Exodus. There's the lamb. There's the meal that we remember, the Passover. And there's bread at that meal. And Jesus took bread and he broke it. Well, that's how you eat bread. And then he says something. He says, this is my body broken for you. Well, what does that mean? And then he takes a cup and he pours it out. And he says, this blood is a new covenant. And they think, what does that mean? The body, the blood, do this in remembrance of me. Jesus is overthrowing these status quo kingdoms that always emerge, and he does it in ways that are totally different. He's not winning elections. He's doing the opposite of what election winning seems to do. He's not starting wars. He's doing the opposite of what violent revolutionaries do. He'll be crucified as if he was one, but he says no. He does the opposite of what demons do. He says no. I am the bread you eat. I'm the wine you drink. I nourish you. I give you life. I correct the disorders within you. And I give you the strength to stand and to love. So on the night he was betrayed, he took bread and he broke it. And he said, this is my body broken for you. As often as you eat this, remember me.